Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday Show with Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Hey, everybody. Today, we're going to deep dive into Thanksgiving in military history. We've got a lot going on. And we're also going to touch base on, since it's November, Veterans Day. So, of course, you know, we love our shows with Mike Guardia. He's an award-winning author, military historian, and U.S. Army veteran, and also named author of the year in 2021 by the Military Writers Society of America. So welcome back, Mike. How are you?
Hi, Lisa. Hi, Nancy. I'm doing great. And it's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Hey, cool. Always fun with you. Military Mike is in the house. Before we get to Thanksgiving, because you know what? I know you've got two stories to share with us. And the one I didn't understand. I always thought it was about the pilgrims for Thanksgiving, but you're going to tell us a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Let's just touch on Veterans Day is coming up, November 11th, Saturday, November 11th. Mm-hmm. And we just recorded a show about, you know, our big weekly blend show with all the different holidays. And we were talking about Veterans Day and Johnny Schaefer. I think you might have been on a show with him, a musician, singer, songwriter. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, on social media, I realized like I started noticing people don't know the difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day.
Right. Yeah.
So what should we know and what do you want people to know for Veterans Day?
Of course. Well, you have Memorial Day. You also have Veterans Day. There's also Flag Day, which is known as Armed Forces Day. And those three separate holidays, they're ones that honor veterans, but they honor them slightly differently. So when we talk about Memorial Day, specifically, that is a day that's dedicated to remembering veterans who have given their lives in the in the service of this nation. So whenever we talk about Memorial Day, you know, we're talking about those who have served in some capacity and you know, have given their lives. Either they've died by hostile fire or they've died in the course of their duties. Mm-hmm. That's really the essence of Memorial Day there. You know, you also have Armed Forces Day, Flag Day, which is honoring all of the armed forces in their entirety. And then you also have Veterans Day, which coincides with the end of World War One. Initially, it was called Armistice Day to celebrate the end of the First World War, the so-called war to end all wars. And they particularly wanted a day to commemorate this war's end because they called it the war to end all wars. This war took the brutality of combat to a level that I don't think any civilized person could have ever foreseen. You know, you had the modern advent of horrible weapons that, you know, produced death on a massive scale. You had, aerial combat. You had rapid fire machine guns, had trench warfare. And then you also had the advent of chemical warfare too. So what they have done in the years since it was called Armistice Day, it has become Veterans Day. And, that is a blanket term that applies to all veterans, whether in the past or in the present, have died in combat, whether they have, died of natural causes, or whether they are a currently serving member of the military, or whether they were a veteran who served during peacetime. So anybody who took that, oath of office and anyone who took that oath to wear the uniform for any period of time is honored on Veterans Day.
Oh, yeah. So I always thought there was a split difference, like, boom. And so now I'm wrong on the show. Anybody listening to the November, 5th through 11th podcast, Big Weekly Blend, don't listen to me. Don't listen to Lisa. Listen to Mike. But it's true because I always thought, like, veterans are for those who are living now and support those now. And Memorial Day is for those who have passed. That's what we always kind of thought.
Actually, my grandmother taught me, if you see a uniform as a child, she said you can salute and they'll laugh at you and be kind to you. As an adult, you better have something behind the salute, like you've served or, that could be almost not a good thing to do. So, but I'll bow down as in, I appreciate your service. I don't fully understand everything you ever did in the history of warfare, in the history of peace, but I appreciate your efforts. And what it did to your families, your relatives, and what it means. Like when somebody goes off to war, it's not just them. And it has consequences down. It has consequences, and people forget that. I think they really do. Yeah. So there should be a remembrance for, yes, fallen soldiers. Yes, those who are still serving. And yes, for the families who support them.
That's the thing, the families, Mike. I always think that all of this, we need to look at, you know, those who have served, like you, you've served, right? And you also were in the reserves, right? And so you're a veteran and someone we appreciate and thank you. But I also believe it's about your family too. And so
it is.
When we look at Veterans Day, Memorial Day, shouldn't we also be not only looking at the soldiers, men and women, but also the families?
Oh, of course. I think, I think the families deserve a recognition all of their own, because, you know, if you serve in the military, whether you do your initial term of service or you, serve for an entire career, it's not just a job. It's really not even a career. It is more of a lifestyle than anything else. And if you have a family, they are integrated into that lifestyle, because the military has a culture all of its own, even amongst the civilian family members. And, the loss is felt, by no one more greater than the families of those who have been killed or wounded in action, or, you know, because they're the ones who have to try to pick up the pieces and try to still function as a family unit, even though a big part of it is missing. You know, and that is a struggle unto itself. And, you know, that reminds me, it's also very timely, because, the whole Veterans Day season coincided very closely with the Battle of Ai Trang in Vietnam back in 1965. That was the battle that Hal Moore led the troops of the 1st and the 7th Cavalry into. And, you know, we all know the opposite side of the story, being that when his wife Julie was, you know, holding down the fort essentially, and she was a point of light for all of those military spouses, you know, she was the primary point of contact for all of the bereaved war widows who were getting those telegrams from across the Pacific, saying that their husbands had been killed in action. And, you know, she essentially had to be she had to be the shepherd, in a matter of speaking, to help all of those bereaved wives, really pick up the pieces. And, it was her efforts that led to a more streamlined process and a system in place to actually make sure that these bereaved war spouses, get the proper care that they need. You know, there's never going to be something that takes the sting out of the loss entirely, but there has to be some kind of permanent support mechanism there, where, you know, they can at least lean on somebody or somebodies to help them make sense out of the insane loss.
Yeah,
it's really
absolutely
true. And I want people to know too that, you know, you talk about Hal Moore's wife and Hal Moore too, you know, that for our new listeners especially, that you wrote books about Hal Moore, award-winning books, Hal Moore, A Soldier Once and Always, and also the biography chronicling his life. So, you know, you've done a lot in regards to Hal Moore. Three books, right? You've got three, because you got the pictures, one, two.
Yes.
Three books, right? So that's important for people to know. But when you think about the veterans, those family, and those who serve now, what would you say, with Veterans Day coming up now, how should we approach that as civilians? What would be the most honorable way? Like Nancy was talking about the little kids saluting, but then don't do it as an adult, do this, don't do that. And then I also know some veterans who just really want to be left alone about it and, you know, They don't want to.
Oh, they have.
They don't.
They need their time.
They
They
don't want
need
to
their
hear
time.
thank you for your service. And so that's, so how do we bridge that? What can we do to understand more and do the right thing as best we can?
Well, I think the best thing to do, it just as a foundational way to start, and I think I've said this in other contexts before, but I think the best thing to do to lay the foundation would be just to be somebody worth fighting for, be somebody who would be worth that sacrifice that all of our veterans have made, whether they gave their lives for this country and or they served a term or they did a tour of duty overseas and came back to society with any number of psychological scars. Is really just to be someone who was worth making that sacrifice for. Be a good person, be a decent person,
Ooh,
be well informed.
Right.
Also be well informed, because you know the people that you put in office, the people you vote for, the decisions
yeah.
that they make are going to directly affect the lives of those people who are serving on the front lines. I think that's a good way to lay the foundation. And aside from that, I would say, you know, the best way to try to help the veteran in a more practical sense, I think, would be to, to just devote as much time as your means would allow to the organizations where you know veterans are going to be. If you could find time to help out at the local VFW or the American Legion, or
yeah.
The DAV, the Disabled American Veterans, they have drives where they will pick up a lot of your used and secondhand items. They'll actually pick it up from the curbside. I know they did that several years ago. I think they still do that. And if they don't have the delivery pickup system, there is a DAV center where you can drop those things off at. But, you know, try to give some portion of your time to the organizations where you know veterans are being served, because if they can, you know, if they at least see that, or if they can feel the downstream effects of that in the form of a donation, that would really be the best way for any number of non-military folks out there to devote their time towards.
I'd love that.
What about also, like, I know you've been on the shows where we've had bed and breakfast that do programs giving a night away for veterans and their loved ones, and then like baking cookies and sending them out to active troops.
Right.
Those things make a difference.
Oh, absolutely they do. Absolutely they do. You know, they really boost the morale for any number of troops out there. And, that actually segues into, a very inspirational anecdote or two that I can think of, because I remember when I was putting together all the information and all of the interview transcripts for the Fires of Babylon and Days of Fury, that so many of those Desert Storm veterans that I interviewed, they were thrilled and they were even bolstered by a lot of the random care packages and notes of encouragement that they got from the folks back home. You know, they said that, you know, even during some of their darkest days, just those words of encouragement or those little small tokens of appreciation went a long way into, you know, reminding them, hey, when I get stuff like this, I know what I'm fighting for. This isn't like Vietnam.
Yeah.
The American people are solidly behind us. And specifically, I can think of one incident, and this I'll never forget. This one right here was a total win for humanity. It was when I was interviewing some Ghost Troop veterans. You know, they had these brand new M2, M3 Bradley fighting vehicles that were shipped into theater, and they were being shipped directly from the factory. You know, these were fresh off of the production lines. And, you know, when they opened up these vehicles for the first time and, you know, they were undoing all of the shrink wrap from all of the controls and breaking out all the boxes of the basic issue items that were included with the vehicle, you know, they would open these items and, you know, out would fall, you know, these bags of candy and all these baked goods and, you know, these little notes that were written by the factory workers. Yeah. Sweet. The factory workers on the line would write notes like, hey, good luck. Stay safe. You know, we're all pulling for you. And, I'm just like, man, that is so incredibly thoughtful.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
That's
so I
sweet.
Think it is interesting. And also, there's a community, Three Rivers, California, right outside Sequoia National Park.
Uh-huh.
And, they have, Heroes Appreciation Weeks in March. It's a small art community, but they go in and it's for armed forces, like currently active, non-active, you know, I don't want to say non-active because they've been active, you know, those are retired in the military or police or in, they give them an award and say thank you. And listen to one of their stories of who they are, or if they're not going to speak, because some people don't want to and don't need to, they stand up, someone will stand up and tell their story, their basic biography of what they've done to serve, for the country. And I think there's so many things we can do. And I think parades are great, but I feel like when those individual things of what you can do, it's meaningful. And what about when we look at, you know, I get so many press releases, as you know, and it's like, you know, press releases about veteran run companies that make it be known like, hey, we're veterans. We started this company. And then also about businesses who hire veterans and go out of their way to make sure, hey, you have a place to come. Because at one point it seemed like there was a gap in veterans getting hired. Because of PTSD and things like that, that people shied away. But as far as I know, whenever you're overcoming something, one of the things you could best do is get busy, you know, and still, you know, get help. Obviously that needs to happen, but, being accepted and knowing that you're still part of the force in a way. Right.
Right. Yeah. I think the veterans community in terms of the corporate world is very strong and it's very close knit. And, I think it's wonderful how well they tend to look out for each other, because I had several comrades in arms. I had quite a few fellow officers who were transitioning out of the military at around the same time I was. And we were very pleasantly surprised by the number of not only the number of job fairs that were catering specifically to veterans, but a lot of headhunter and recruiting companies that were run by veterans and specifically matching veterans to potential employers. By way of example, there was one company commander who I had. And he was beginning to transition out of the military. He made the hard decision after 8 years on active duty that he was going to leave the active force. And he went to a job fair that was specifically hosted by one of these veteran run headhunters. And they would host about, I'd say, 35 to 50 veterans per conference, and they would set them up in a hotel. And they would do these round robin interviews in a series of hotel rooms with a lot of these prospective employers.
Yikes.
And they would be employers that ran the gamut from like Feral Gas to BAE. I think GM had a few representatives there. But, you know, you would interview for positions in a specific line of work, whether it was sales or operations or logistics. Something that could be tied directly back to whatever experience that you had in the military. A lot of it, really a lot of it being mid-level management. But it was the kind of fair where you interviewed with what was essentially a test battery of employers, and you would leave there with a handful of offers. And many of the fellow officers that I knew who would attend these conferences would come back and said, yeah, you know, I got a job offer from ExxonMobil, or I had a job offer from Bank of America. And, they would be very pleased. And then, would check in on them a few years later and they'd say, yeah, well, you know, this was a great way for me to get my foot in the door. And, you know, I spent 3 to 4 years or whatever it was as a production supervisor. And then I was able to leverage that experience into an upper management position at another company. So, you know, whether you use it as a springboard or whether you find a permanent post-Army home, it always tends to work out for the better.
I love that.
Yeah, that's a also good thing, you know, because it gives you time to get your footing and regroup and rethink. No, I think that's awesome.
Well, it is, because it is a change from being going from military to civilian work life is two different things. But it's, you know, I think that's also why Hal Moore Lessons in Leadership, that book is so good, right? Doesn't that also for your book when you wrote that? And I know you also do seminars on that. Does that help military individuals go like, you know, hey, I'm leaving the military and going into, you know, corporate or business? It doesn't really matter. You know, leadership can be anything.
Right.
Self-leadership, it starts with self-leadership, right?
Yeah,
so does that book and those lessons help?
I think it does. You know, I mean, there are some baseline soft skills that you can refine in the military, leadership and management being one of them. It's something that shows that you are adaptable and that you are also resilient. And it shows that, you know, even if you're going into a line of work with which you're not entirely familiar with, say, like if you were an artillery officer and you did like a 5 or 6 year tour of duty, and then suddenly you get a job offer to be an operations manager with a natural gas company, you know, the fact that you know how to run teams and you know how to psychologically read people and know how to motivate and keep the momentum of a group going forward, that right there is a good foundation. And, you know, you, if you start with that and you get your foot in the door that way, you find that a lot of these veterans, they have a very steep learning curve to, not only learn the ins and outs of the industry, but also be very innovative and, be incredibly flexible to think on their feet. And if I can use just one example, I remember in the case of my dad, as a matter of fact, when he first left the military before, you know, he went on to before he went on to bigger and better things in the oil and gas industry, when he left. And I think I'm remembering the story correctly. And if not, he can correct me later. But I remember him telling me his first job after he left the service was as, I believe it was a production supervisor for an oil and gas company, overseeing this one particular team. And, you know, within only a few weeks on the job, you know, he found ways to improve, a lot of the internal processes there. And, you know, saved both time and money for the whole team. And, you know, that was just one of the big contributions that he had there during his first year. And, you know, that set the foundation for him to go on and do bigger and better things. So, you know, that's a personal example. That's a personal example that, that I can give.
No, that's awesome. That's awesome.
The other thing I wanted to touch on just on some of the past discussions is, when, you know, veterans transitioning into a new field is veterans, those who were fighter pilots, you're talking about this, that a lot of them actually end up, you know, being pilots for commercial airlines, like, you know, Boeing or like American Airlines or Southwest or whatever, but even cargo, you know, that they still fly. And, you know, when you think about moving on your feet and even this, you know, we know pilots and some of the pilots we know, they're like, oh no, we are trained, like if stuff goes down, to handle it. And so I think about that in the security of air, you know, flight and transporting people, and that you do want someone from the military or a fighter pilot to be taking you across the sea.
Well, you want somebody educated in what could happen and what you do if it does happen. And I know they do repeated exercises to make sure that it's almost second reflex. They don't just like, oh, here, read this manual and then get it right. on the day that something might happen. They do repeated exercise. As far as what I've read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they exercise and repeat the exercises till it's almost second nature. Am I wrong?
No, you're not right. You know, I mean, that really is the basis of how you learn. You know, repetition is the mother of all learning.
Yeah. So,
yeah,
I mean,
that's that. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Wow. So lots of information for Veterans Day. And remember, it's not just one day. Just
correct.
Saying, you know, that we've got to bring that up. So, Mike, Thanksgiving,
yes,
military
ma'am.
History. So, Thanksgiving is not just about the pilgrims and the Native Americans getting together. And there's a whole bunch of history on that that people get, you know, I don't want to rile up the history stuff. You know what I mean? Let's not get political, but, honestly, I did not know this, about George Washington. So can you tell us about that? Because, I really,
of course.
Was I mean, that is a difference that maybe we don't realize, right? Is it just me? Because I don't know.
Well, no, because, you know, the history of Thanksgiving in America, it has a rather long and a pretty convoluted history. I mean, if we wind the clocks back to the 1600s when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, and, you know, we take a look at some of their early struggles and their interactions with Samoset and Squanto, and how they gave thanks, you know, and how they broke bread with the Native Americans, saying, hey, we give thanks to God and our friends, the natives here, for, you know, for being able to survive the harsh conditions here in the wilderness, all in the name of religious freedom and tolerance. You know, it is true that that's where it started, but it had a very slow path to catching on, because, you know, you had that first tradition there with the Pilgrims and the Native Americans. And yeah, that's where we can point to its origin, but it really wasn't formalized until over a century later, because, you know, that first celebration was, it was remembered, but it wasn't commemorated every year. You know, if we look back through history, you know, the feast at the Plymouth Colony was just one point, and then it wasn't until 1777 that we see a more formal incarnation of Thanksgiving. Now, if we take a look at the timeline here, the fall of 1777, we were right smack dab in the middle of the American Revolution. And things were not going very well for the Continental Army at this point.
Right.
You know, we'd already signed and ratified the Declaration of Independence. We were more than 2 years at this point into the active shooting war against the British, and we really only had one appreciable victory to point to, and that was at the Battle of Trenton. That was where we broke tradition by fighting on Christmas, and we, you know, crossed the frozen Delaware River. That's where you have that iconic picture of George Washington in the boat, and they're crossing the river, and what looks like to be icebergs in there. So that was really the first appreciable victory we had. But by the middle of 1777, it looked like we were still on the ropes. We had gotten in a few lucky punches, but we really needed a big, solid victory that we could point to, you know, in an open field battle. And the Second Battle of Saratoga really gave us that victory we needed. Now, historians can debate as to whether or not Saratoga was the turning point or whether Trenton was the turning point. But the fact remains that after the Battle of Saratoga was done, and it was clear that we had won the day, we said, you know what, we really need to have a day of remembrance and a day to give gratitude for this victory that we've had against the British. We considered it a godsend. So what George Washington did was he called for a day of Thanksgiving that was on December 18th of that year. and he was celebrating the victory of the colonial army and their win against the British. And, you know, of course, you fast forward a few years later, the British have their final defeat at the Battle of Yorktown in 1781. And then 2 years later, we have our independence formally recognized. Well, when George Washington officially becomes the first president of the United States, he was the one to issue the formal declaration of a Thanksgiving Day, quote unquote. And that was when, you know, during his first year in office, and he set the date for November 26 of 1789. Mm. Well, that was the first formal observance of Thanksgiving Day. But it still really didn't catch on as an annual tradition. It was more of a token holiday that was proclaimed that people knew was there, but they didn't really celebrate. And it was just kind of a thing that you knew was going on in the background. It was a, I don't even know if this is a good analogy. It's probably just the best one that I can think of at the moment. It's like, you know, happy Bosses Day or Happy Siblings Day. Or,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, it's true. Yeah. 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 It was more of a token holiday than anything else.
If it doesn't pertain to you personally, you're like, so what?
Yeah. So, you know, it was something that we just looked at as like, oh, you know, hey, this is a point in history when something happened. It was a long time ago. You know, it's like, let's celebrate the anniversary of whatever. But you fast forward about 75 years later when we're in the middle of the Civil War. And now the need to give thanks really takes on a new meaning because this is a crisis that is quite literally ripping our nation apart. And it was in 1863 that Abraham Lincoln decided that he was going to renew the celebration at the height of the Civil War, saying, hey, in the middle of this very trying time in our nation's history, which no one has ever experienced before, let's give a day of thanks and let's be thankful for the things that we still have. The outcome of this war is still up in the air, but you know what? Let's make this an official tradition instead of just a random federal holiday that's on the books. So for many years thereafter that, I think after the Civil War ended, and I think more so even after Lincoln's assassination, the presidents who followed them said, okay, well, this is a tradition we need to keep up if for nothing else than to honor Abe Lincoln's legacy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, hey, coming back together after a bloody civil war. Yeah, I think we should take pause to be grateful that this bloody conflict is over.
Yeah, he rallied the troops in his own personal way.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, even though it became a cyclic holiday at that point, there was still a lot of confusion as to which day in November it would actually fall on. And, and there were, you know, because, normally it would be, you know, like, okay, whatever, is the final Thursday of the month. But, you know, oddly enough, again, we have a turning point during a time of conflict, and it was World War II. World War II, where 2 years in a row, November had five Thursdays. So, this was causing a lot of confusion amongst a lot of people saying, okay, which one are we celebrating? Is it going to be the fourth Thursday, the fifth Thursday? And, you know, it's like last year we only had four Thursdays. What are we doing here, guys? And then it was finally in 1942 that Congress passed its resolution, making it an official law saying, hey, every fourth Thursday of November is going to be Thanksgiving Day. It doesn't matter if November has five Thursdays or four. No. It's always going to be that fourth Thursday of November.
Yeah.
And, you know, they said, you know, that's just going to be the day that it's observed. Yeah. The pilgrims probably had a different concept of, when Thursday was, or, you know, what time of the week that it was supposed to fall on, but that's going to be the day, signed, sealed, delivered, that we're going to celebrate a day of thanks. And it made it clear that, you know, hey, we should keep this tradition going forward because we were the first nation really to make a national holiday celebrating thanks. So, yeah.
Wow.
But I mean, and it is true, whether it's the wrong date or the right date, the sentiment
Right.
is the same. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. So so on all of this, yeah, so the pilgrim thing was kind of like a symbolic thing, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because the Indian side of it are like, dude, we gave you this and then you screwed us, you know? So,
yeah, I get that too.
See, I'm not as eloquent as Mike, sorry. But I mean, I'm just, you know, brass tacks on it. It just, you know. So this is really fascinating. So now what about, so now we have Thanksgiving every fourth Thursday. I think it's cool. It's
but
the same thing as when we talk about
Native
Veterans Day.
Americans participated in the first Thanksgiving. They did.
That was the first, that's when people landed, you know.
But I mean,
That's a symbolic thing of unity, but it really isn't true because then there was Indian wars and things, you know.
Yeah.
So the unity later didn't happen. Even though there was unity and giving at the beginning, it didn't last that long. It's kind of like family fights during Thanksgiving. Everyone's happy when they all get together, and then by the end of the evening, someone did something somewhere they shouldn't. Just kidding.
No.
But yeah, I'm just kidding. But you know what I mean? It's interesting to me, the evolution of Thanksgiving, Mike. I did not know all this at all. Well, I think most people just go right to the pilgrim times, you know, of Thanksgiving. So yeah. I mean, and that's kind of still close when you think of it, right?
Right.
About the timeline, or am I way off? Am I off a couple hundred years?
Well,
My timeline's out.
If we take a bird's eye view of it, then yeah, I mean, it is pretty close. I mean, you know, the couple hundred years in the grand history of the world, I mean, it's really
nothing.
not all that much. Yeah.
No, it's nothing.
Nothing by the hundred millions. Yeah.
But things can change in 200 years drastically.
Yeah.
Changes can occur that are radical.
Yeah.
That you're like, oh, well, it's only 200 years. What could happen?
Mm-hmm.
A whole bunch of stuff could happen.
Yeah. So now what about what happened in Luxembourg?
Somebody had a party, I heard. Am I right? A little bit of
tell
us about Luxembourg. This is
okay.
Now, yeah. Tell us about that because so now Thanksgiving because 40.
Yeah.
You were saying 1942, and then
What's
now
it?
it's a new
Like,
thing. So
okay.
Luxembourg was this country, then it was that country, then it was this country. It's
right.
Like on the border or something. It kept switching identities.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's an incredible story. So, So if you take the country of Luxembourg, that, it's one of the smallest countries in the world. And, certainly a small, tiny little outlet there in Western Europe. Well, American GIs and the civilians in Luxembourg, they actually shared a Johnny on the spot Thanksgiving celebration in November of 1944. And 1944 was really the watershed year in a lot of ways for at least the Western Allied effort, because, you know, now we had now we firmly had Italy within the Allied fold. We had established that base of operations there on the Italian peninsula. We had invaded not only northern France but also southern France. And we were consolidating all of our forces within occupied France. We were pushing forward, and we were pushing the Axis forces to the very, very border of the fatherland. And yeah, things were really looking to turn solidly in the Allies' favor. And, of course, November of 1944, that's right before the Battle of the Bulge. But, as we are crossing the borders from France into Germany proper, that's when that's when the tiny country of Luxembourg, which for many, I think, was just an afterthought, you know, it,
yeah.
You know, it came to, you know, it came to pass that, oh yeah, there's this tiny little speck of territory between the two bigger nations of France and Germany. And of course it's being occupied. So we have to liberate this and, you know, and put this within the allied occupied mm-hmm. territory now. So let's see. So at this point, Luxembourg had been firmly under the Nazis' thumb for the better part of 4 years. And it was finally in September of 1944 that the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg was liberated from Nazi control. Mm-hmm. And it actually became an R&R billet for the number of U.S. troops who were in the European theater. Because, you know, you try to rotate these troops on and off the line so that they don't suffer from too much battle fatigue. Well, one of the places that they would go to get some in-theater rest and recuperation and also, you know, also mm-hmm. Also some medical recuperation to determine whether or not they could be sent back to the front lines or whether they would have to be medically shipped back home was Luxembourg. So thousands of GIs were stationed there temporarily, you know, for any rest and relaxation. And part of any R&R leave, you know, you also have some opportunities for recreation. And, you know, as they were retooling themselves and also retooling their equipment, you know, the citizens of Luxembourg, and being that it is such a small country, it's a very tight knit community in there. You know, many of the people are related and they know each other. So they decided to get together and say, you know what? We really need to show our appreciation for these American GIs who are here. They're a force for good and they're here to get rid of the Nazis. So they wanted to show genuine gratitude, and despite the very big language barrier, because you know they didn't have mm-hmm. a lot of translators. You know, the people of Luxembourg came out in force to you know, provide some fun and provide some entertainment, and more than anything, provide some food for a lot of these weary GIs. So mm-hmm. In the farming villages and the small towns, all throughout Greater Luxembourg, you know, you had a lot of these farm communities hosting these Thanksgiving dinners, hosting these games and these activities for a lot of these troops. And you know, the troops took incredibly well to it, not only on account of the hospitality, but the fact that these Luxembourg citizens were just tremendous cooks. I mean, they take homemade cooking and baking to a whole new level, you know, to the point that many of these GIs had never seen before. And keep in mind that a lot of these recruits and draftees are, you know, coming off the throes of the Great Depression, where, you know, getting three square meals a day was something that was pretty hard to come by. So if you're being fed by these very generous people of Luxembourg, and you know, you've gone from eating maybe once a day, if you're lucky, to maybe getting three canned rations a day, and then boom, mm-hmm. you're suddenly treated to all of these loaves of bread, all these pies, all of these birds of prey that have been skinned, skewered, and cooked for your delight. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's probably the closest thing to heaven you're going to find on the front lines.
I told you this was a party, was, and it's a widespread one. That's mm-hmm. When we were in South Africa, we were doing the tour with Nancy's artwork, and she was doing it as a fundraiser for the National Cancer Association. And so we ended up staying in different homes and all kinds of like people's homes and that were, fundraising and stuff. You know, we were doing all these different events, and we were somewhere and they heard that we were American. And they put on a Thanksgiving feast for us. And I'd never mm-hmm. had Thanksgiving because I didn't grow up there, you know. And they did a sweet potato pie, as close mm-hmm. as what they thought we had, yams or whatever. It's not like they could Google it back then. Way back when. And they did what they – I mean, I don't even remember eating turkey. And I don't remember eating that much turkey.
They did what they thought.
They could replicate.
American-
yeah.
Thanksgiving would be like.
It
And
was the sweetest thing
it was
ever.
way better, I have to say.
Oh, don't say that. But I mean, it was really thoughtful, and Nancy and I were totally taken aback. Like,
Yeah, it was
somebody went out
amazing.
of their way to remember our
It was
holidays
amazing.
in this country. And I think that's pretty special. Just to have been on that side of
Amazing.
it is amazing. It was
Yeah.
sweet, you know? And I don't know, it's just really thoughtful. It goes with what we were talking about for Veterans Day, right? About those thoughtful moments, what can
Well,
change
just
people's world, you know?
stopping to think. Okay, that's the first step. Stop to think, and then to appreciate. Okay, that would be the second step. And the third step would be take some kind of action, whether it be a donation or helping a veteran that lives next to you that needs some help or something. Stop thinking, then act. It just is part of being human, as opposed to being so wrapped up in your own stuff. Yeah, and we get that way. We do. We all do. So it's not like anybody's being evil or anything. You get wrapped
No.
up in your own stuff to cope with it because everything moves so fast. But
Yeah.
stop thinking and take some action to do something outside your.
Yeah, well, that's for everyone. I mean, in general. So I
Well,
agree with
yeah, and
that.
for us, yeah, because I mean, if we don't help each other, we're going to be in trouble down the
Right.
road.
Well, isn't that part of, you know, the stories you share, Mike, in your books? Like, even going to Hell Moor, look how many people he rescued.
That's
You
right.
know, he went beside himself, and that's what the military does. They risk everything. Everything. Life. Life is everything, right? And so that's something to think about. And I wanted to bring up your next books. So what's happening? I know. Okay, are we at 21 or 22 now? I always have to regroup on how many books you have.
This is 25, actually. Yeah,
Oh,
so I
what a
have, yep,
dude. But I'm still behind then. Yeah, that's okay. I can't keep up with you, Mike. It's okay. It's okay. Number 25 is what's coming out next. Wow. So
Yeah,
tell
it is.
everybody. Sneak preview.
Yeah, so I have finished the draft to a book called Fire in the Hole, and that is a story about Charlie Company of the 1st Engineer Battalion when they served in Vietnam. And for any listeners out there who are unfamiliar with the combat engineers, essentially what they do is they are your battlefield demolitions experts. They have everything to do with minefields. They either set minefields, they clear minefields, they build tactical obstacles, they dig tank ditches. They use a lot of earthenworks, and they do everything they can to assist the maneuver forces in terms of setting up obstacles that that will slow or impede the enemy's movement. And aside from that, they move and they function alongside the maneuver forces. And whenever required, they also fight as provisional infantrymen. And they have such a critical role on the battlefield. And it's kind of surprising that they don't get more stories told about them in the course of mainstream history. So some of the stories that are included with this book that I just finished, tell not only of the perils of being a combat engineer in Vietnam, but it's also against the backdrop of that first year of America's combat mission over there. And it's so interesting to see the trajectory of American public opinion throughout that war, because the first year that we
Yeah.
were over there in the true combat mission, this was 1965 to 1966, when the 1st Engineer Battalion arrived there, The majority of Americans were solidly behind the mission. I mean, they were,
Absolutely.
I mean, they were getting letters of encouragement from the home
Yep.
front. You know,
Absolutely.
they were being seen off with, you know, people who were waving the American flag. We thought that this mission was part of the greater crusade against communism.
Yep.
It was. I mean, it was just poorly executed at the strategic level. But you know, the sentiment was all the same. That, you know, even though most of these guys were draftees and they were only serving a small term of service, you know, the troops who deployed there with the class of 1965, they were incredibly competent in what they did. They had a belief in the mission. They had a belief in each other. You know, and they were just making monkeys out of the Viet Cong left and right. And you know, when they redeployed home, it was still a somewhat warm reception for them, because 1966, America is still very much in favor of the war. The body counts are all in our favor. It wasn't really until after the Tet Offensive that public backlash just went crazy. I mean, and you know, it was interesting to see how these guys, because when they came back, some of them ended up serving second tours, others ended up returning to civilian life. But they said it was so hard for us to wrap our heads around, because we went over there and everything was fine. And then, you know, just like about a year or two after we came back, we see a lot of our we see a lot of our brothers in arms, you know, coming back from Vietnam, and people are spitting on them, people are protesting, people are calling them
horrible baby
killers, and we're like, my God, what the hell happened? Yeah,
I can tell you what happened. It was the press. I don't know why it changed, but the press about the Vietnam War, and a little bit even before, and it's political. I, in my mind, go back to who were the senators, who were the congressmen.
Mm-hmm.
It's political, and they control the press, whether people want to hear that or not. Sorry, but there it is. And as you know, growing up during that era, and I was so, oh my God, so many of my friends went to Vietnam. I was like heartbroken, because I didn't think they'd come back, and a lot of them didn't. And the press, I was like, screw you, assholes. What do you say?
So nice, Nancy.
No, I'm sorry.
I agree.
Yeah, I was so pissed off about the way they talk about people who sacrifice their life to protect our country. And the idea of democracy and freedom. I'm still angry. Can't get past it. I was so angry, but I'm still angry about the stupidity, blockheadness, like, I'm going to start getting
sorry. Okay, Nancy. That's cool.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But that's how I felt, and I still feel that way. I haven't changed my mind at all. I think the people who went to Vietnam, due to the, they tried to protect this country.
And some were forced into it as it being drafted, right? So, that's the other part of it too. You're here in this country and you're being drafted. And so, You're going to have to do that, and people,
but I think,
you know,
I don't think anybody signed up to be evil.
No,
they put their life on the line. So these people,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah. Anyway, there's.
I'm sorry. I get emotional.
When do you think this is going to come out, Mike?
Well, actually, I'm doing what I can to expedite the process and get this to market in time for the 1st of December. I mean, the draft itself is done. I just got to put it through the production timeline, which, you know, is actually a pretty quick turnaround.
The process.
Yeah. If I can get this out, because the selling season will start to ramp up for book sales right around Black Friday. And if I can get this out in time for Cyber Monday, man, that'll be great, because it'll be hitting critical mass in time for the holiday season, which stays relatively high throughout January. And I've noticed for military history, the big seasons for that are November, December, spilling over into January, of course, because of the holidays. But then also May to early July, because that not only straddles Memorial Day, it also straddles a lot of graduations and Father's Day and Flag Day and also the 4th of July. So those are big, selling seasons.
That's military history.
It's interesting about that. And at the same time, I'm like, everyone support a veteran who's writing about military history, 25 darn books. My God. And they're good. And listen, even if you don't understand the military, be like me and start reading them and you'll start to learn. I mean, Mike's books are telling the stories of people. Some of them do get into like the gear of a, you know, F-15, but I never thought I'd even know what an F-15 was, or an F-14 or any of that, you know. But that's the thing. I encourage people to check them out, because you're going to hear the stories. We all love those stories. And Mike finds these heroes and people just did stuff, you know, did good stuff, and all for our country and people in the country. So I encourage you to check it out. Go to MikeGuardia.com and follow him on YouTube. Man, he does all kinds of cool stuff on YouTube, on Facebook, on Instagram. He's there now. He's been there all year. It's cool. And Twitter. X is the spot, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But he's there too. But follow him, because he's always posting cool information. And when his new book comes out, you'll be the first to know, because if you follow him, you will. And of course, we'll have him back on December, first Monday in December. He's here every first Monday. So, we're going to have to do some more good stuff. And maybe we'll be talking about your new book if all goes well. Right, Mike? So we're looking forward to that. It'll be fun. Thank you so much, as always. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Mike. And hey,
Mike. Ladies. Yes,
happy
ma'am.
Thanksgiving and happy Veterans Day.
And a very happy Veterans and Thanksgiving Day to you.
Thank you. Back at you.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show, featuring Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Keep up with Mike and his books at MikeGuardia.com. Follow us at BigBlendRadio.com.